Okay. Dear students, colleagues, and our guests, I think it is time to get started. It is my honor to welcome you all to the 2016 Jyväskylä University Education Research Spring Colloquium. And at the same time, it's my pleasure to warmly welcome you to this plenary session organized by the Master's Degree Program in Sociology and Politics of Education. This master's degree program is provided jointly by the departments of education at three universities, Helsinki, Turku and Jyväskylä. And every semester, each of the universities have organized a seminar under a specific topic. And this semester at Jyväskylä, our theme is education governance. Last September, here at Jyväskylä, an international education for all seminar entitled Local Meets Global, Education for Culturally and Socially Sustainable Development was organized. Now, our Education Research Spring Colloquium is put together under the theme of changing environments of learning and growth. And we are addressing questions like how have environments of learning and growth changed in the light of research? And in response to these changes, what kind of educational research in learning environments is conducted at Jyväskylä? It was not really our deliberate aim to try to link these themes that I just mentioned, but it seems that in practice we have managed to put together an interesting combination of topics which do interlink and intersect in various ways. One way to think of these relations is to look at how international educational governance enables and or constrains changes and development of learning environments, both at the local and global levels. Other ways of focus our lenses in looking at these issues and relations are interestingly addressed by our keynote speakers today, for which reason I am delighted to have Professors Unterhalter and Meyer presenting this afternoon. Before introducing our first keynote speaker, I'd like to tell briefly about some practical issues with regards to this session. So we are first having the keynote by Professor Unterhalter, approximately 40 minutes, after which there is some time allocated for our invited discussants, Drs. Terhi Nokkala, Elina Lehtomäki and David Hoffman. Maybe if you could just briefly show who you are. Okay, Elina is not here. Terhi, Elina and David will address their comments and questions to Elaine. And then after, we are opening the floor to you for the audience. Around 2:30, we are having a coffee break, and the coffee will be served right behind the door at the lobby. And while you're enjoying the coffee, I'm hoping to get connected with Professor Meyer, who is in New York, without any technical problems. And at 3 p.m., we are having his keynote entitled Do We Need a Global Education Policy? I'd like to highlight that our session is not a formal and structured conference plenary session, but instead, as discussed in the morning with Terhi, Elina and David, we'd like to encourage for active participation and dialogue. And we'd like us to be a discussive group of junior and senior researchers. And we here behind the table and you over there are only facilitating and moderating our dialogue. So the way we see it, this is a learning experience for all of us. So let's all try to create an inspiring and open learning environment. I think we also have quite unique chance to really discuss and debate about the role of education and the role of educational research. So let's try to use it in an optimal way. So far, any questions or comments? Right. Now, on behalf of the Faculty of Education and Master's Degree Program in Sociology and Politics of Education, it is my absolute pleasure to welcome you, Professor Unterhalter, to Jyväskylä and Finland, and this joint plenary. Elaine is Professor of Education and International Development at the Institute of Education, University College of London, and she is an expert on issues of international education, global educational policies, social justice and gender in particular. Professor Unterhalter has coordinated a number of research projects across a number of African countries with multilateral organizations and international NGOs. She has worked on research projects in Bangladesh, Tanzania, Nigeria, Kenya, and South Africa, to name a few. She has written a number of books and journal articles and contributed to many edited collections. Her recent books include a textbook called Education and International Development, An Introduction, Global Inequalities in and Higher Education, Whose Interests Are We Serving? And Amartya Sen's Capability Approach and Social Justice in Education. Her other recent works include a report for the British Council on the post-2015 framework in relation to higher education, and a literature review on girls' schooling and gender equality, funded by the UK Department for International Development. So once again, Elaine, welcome, and please, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Mariana, and thanks very much for inviting me. And I'm really looking forward to this opportunity to talk with you and hear your views on this issue. This talk, however, I'm a little bit nervous, so I'm going to read it, and I hope that the kind of density of the arguments doesn't get in the way of the conversations Mariana has invited us to have. The key idea about governance I want to develop in this talk hinges on a metaphor, multipolarity, which I want to use to bring out the complexities that take us forward in this post-2015 global education frameworks, which have been enacted in a world of growing and staggering and overlapping inequalities, which this technical term, multidimensional inequalities, hardly conveys the complexity and suffering and violence associated with the notion. Our divided but shared world is one where the promises of education and economic growth or enhanced social solidarity have been achieved only for some. In some parts of the world, trends in access to school are going downward, and you only have to see night by night the film from Syria, from the Middle East, but indeed other parts of Africa, millions of children now out of school. And we hadn't done so well before. The effects of this war and the challenges are now massive. I want to consider multipolarity then as a metaphor for thinking about some of these things: suffering, injustice, inequality. Multipolarity is a double-sided word. I think it helps to try to understand some of the confusion and complexity of the post-2015 terrain. And in this talk, I'm going to be looking primarily at the Sustainable Development Goals, SDGs, which I hope are reasonably familiar to you. And I want to consider how they present and confront multidimensional and overlapping inequalities. So here's the logo for the Sustainable Development Goals and the vision that they encapsulated in the SDG publicity. And you, they present this vision of a post-2015 world. And while they place sustainable development at the center, I think the logo could just as easily put educational as sustainable development in the center, as education threads through all the themes of the SDGs and in many ways expresses both the universality, the particularity, and the integration that the goals aspire to. So before discussing multipolarity, I just want to recap about the world before 2015 in relation to global education frameworks, which I hope is reasonably familiar to everyone. In 2015, we moved beyond a global education landscape sculpted largely by two soft power global governance frameworks linked largely to an aid agenda: the Millennium Development Goals, the MDGs, and Education for All, or EFA. Although a number of somewhat older frameworks linked with rights, gender equality, and inclusion were also part of the mix up to 2015, their scope in leading policy and practice was contested, sometimes explicitly, sometimes by omission or superficial engagement. Indeed, the shift from government to governance as organizing ideas in the period from the 1990s partly had an impact on diffusing some of the ways in which rights and equalities had been considered in the older frameworks. From 2000 to 2015, the targets associated with MDG 2 and 3 and the six goals of the Dakar EFA framework moved the global social justice agenda in education away from what Charles Gore has called a broadly procedural approach to reviewing and contextualizing rights through participatory processes in which governments were key players and ideas of public good were a major theme in relation to education. That approach, which had a feature of global education policy frame, which had been a feature of global education policy framing from the 1970s, gave place in the MDGs to what Gore has called a purposive view, that is, counting how many children crossed a line of enrollment, progression, or attainment. Although, so purposive is you cross the line. The global education framework was just concerned with counting that level of results. Although quality was not an MDG target, the linking of quality to a narrow interpretation of education outcomes in relation to test scores fitted very well with the purposive view of global education frameworks. These invoked versions of results-based management and relied heavily on audit and counting as means of evaluation. Governance was a key notion because a decentered government stressed accountability without clarifying accountability of whom, to what, or why. The slipperiness of the idea of governance enabled many different agendas to coalesce around EFA, including a range of public-private initiatives. Processes like citizen-led testing surveys were seen by some as a key strategy to hold governments to account. But the politics had different implications in different settings. Aspects of education that could not be simply measured or audited in this way, like equalities or freedom from violence or ideas about social justice and the public good in whatever way that might be defined, tended not to be located on this roadmap for global education governance. Now, some of these omissions about the results-based management frame of the MDGs and the perspectives they derived from were revisited in the ferment of activity that led up to the formulation of the SDGs in 2015. The associated targets of the SDGs and the Incheon Declaration on Education for All in 2015. So in contrast to the way the MDGs had been formulated, it's alleged by six men sitting in a basement in a room in New York, the SDGs, like the Incheon Declaration, emerged from a participatory process. This was uneven, chaotic, somewhat shallow, but nonetheless considerably more democratic and inclusive than the processes that had taken place in 2000, which precipitated the Dakar and MDG documents. This process put governments, institutions, and notions of governance into a discussion with ideas about process and outcomes which have recontoured the global education landscape regarding policy and practice. So this is what we have. The 17 SDGs are much more the project of the member states of the UN than the MDGs ever were, because the MDGs were largely seen as a project of the aid organizations. Incheon, in which civil society was a very active player, articulates much better with the SDGs than the Dakar framework did. The SDG targets in education, and this is a slimmed-down version of them, have not limited a global project on education rights simply to expand access to primary levels or focused only on developing countries. You can see the wide range of levels of education covered by SDG 4. The large ambition of the SDG framework sees education threading together many of the targets. In a way, the MDGs perversely fail to recognize, with a focus simply on primary education and gender parity. The SDGs give education a role that is potentially holistic and able to put into practice some of the values of equity and leave no child behind, which are part of the SDG framework. In the idea of the SDGs, the idea of rights has come to be repositioned and contextually located. Both governments and governance are invoked, and there is a specific goal on inequality. In my view, these are all gains. In some of the negotiations between 2014 and 2015, I was concerned that a substantive meaning of gender equality in education might drop off the policy agenda. In some of the drafts, it wasn't there. Remarkably, it was reinstated, and it was reinstated partly because of the lobbying that took place at the Incheon conference in May 2015. And it was the lobbying was successful because of the work of a very well organized and highly alert group of equality activists. So it shows that this participatory process had a great deal of edge. This concern with equality, the concern with substantive gender equality, the concern with holism, these have all been issues that in the research projects I've done over the last 10 years on the MDGs, we've always been calling for. So you can see that in a very geeky way, I'm really pleased with this kind of text. But I also can't lose the kind of critical, sociological, political stance which has been part of my education and my academic biography. And so what I want to do now is to consider how the issue of inequality has come to be addressed in the education dimensions of the SDGs and how we can understand this new global governance agenda. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about how we might understand gender. This is the text that I was so pleased about, that it's reinstated gender equality, human rights, and citizenship as major aspects of the SDG framework that are to be audited and reviewed. But now I want to look at thinking about gender as indeed other areas of intersecting inequality as sites of struggle. And what I want to try to draw out in this slide is that the meaning of gender equality in education is not set. And by this discussion, I'm not recapping the old debate, is gender about biology or is it about social relations? I want to show how that the governance agendas and the policy texts have situated gender in two completely different ways. So this is the my attempt to show in a diagram how the MDG framework contained the notion of gender to mean just counting the number of girls and boys. So the dynamic of gender relations, the aspiration around equality, what I've called what gender does or what gender dreams, is all limited and funneled down a very narrow pathway of what gender is, how many girls, how many boys. And I want to contrast that with a framework that's emerged around a very multipolar or dynamic description or discussion of gender, where what gender is, what gender does, what gender dreams, where gender goes, how gender intersects with other inequalities. There's a much more mixed framework. And the SDGs, partly because, I'll just check if this is the next slide. No. Okay, I'll just go. This is SDG Goal 5, which is the gender slide, gender goal. It opens up a wider debate about what gender is, which I think by implication opens up a wider debate about what other kinds of inequalities are. They're not just to be counted in terms of numbers of people crossing a particular line. I think the debate about measurement encapsulates this discussion. Measurement has been a key instrument of governance, and the advance in our capacities to measure and to measure more complexly has gone side by side with the growth of ideas about governance in relation to international policy frameworks. And thinking about gender, what gender equality in education, how to measure it, there are two tracks. There's the narrow track, which has been to think about gender is only gender parity. So what we're measuring is that ratio of girls over boys. And we get perverse results when we are only thinking about gender in terms of measuring gender parity. Because in systems, education systems, where there are more women than men participating in education, you can say that there aren't any gender inequality issues. Even though there might be pervasive violence against women, there's very marked discrimination in relation to the labor market and political participation, and yet there are large numbers of women in education. So gender parity is a very thin measure of gender equality in education. And what I've been doing some work with UNESCO and colleagues in the UN Girls Education Initiative has been on developing a much better, more institutionally located measure of gender equality in education that talks much more to a diverse and dynamic notion of gender. So what this digression into the measurement debate is wanting to illuminate for you is the notion of how the SDG agenda and the debate around indicators that it has precipitated has opened up a kind of multipolar discussion about governance. But I now want to take you to talk about, think about how we what multipolarity is. The word is bandied around a bit, and I actually want to unpack that. I think there are two very different meanings of the term. Okay. And I'm going to then draw out that idea, the two different ideas of multipolarity, to talk about how we can understand the FDGs. Within international relations, the notion of multipolarity is sometimes used as a shorthand to indicate changes in power away from a unipolar world directed by US coordination, leadership, or dominance, depending on your viewpoint. Multipolarity as a term is used to characterize features of the present governance agenda where it is not clear whether geopolitics is directed by processes of balance, tipping points, hard or soft power. And often all of those are happening at the same time. Multipolarity is also used by governments in emerging economically influential states such as the BRICS to express a notion of equal sovereignty, or an alternative to visions of global governance articulated by the US or the EU. Institutions like the BRICS Bank underpin the concept, as do gatherings like the G20, each of which suggests different governance notions and connections of accountability. In this perspective, multipolarity is about realism, negotiating with the geopolitical powers that exist. Some argue that acknowledging these realities and their contradictions, one can still hope to edge forward values around rights, equality, sustainability, social solidarities, or minimizing conflict. And I think that's the UN position. Others point out that these normative concerns get bracketed or are picked up selectively, and all kinds of other desired processes are being advanced associated with the multipolarity argument, which might include free trade or all kinds of forms of governments. What this stress on a very diffuse notion of multipolarity that accepts the global geopolitical order does is it really leaves open the normative questions in relation to education. So why does accountability in education matter? What kind of accountability? Who is accountable to whom and why? What's a very substantive questions. Okay, I want to contrast that realist notion of multipolarity coming out of international relations with the second meaning of multipolarity. And I'm drawing here on the work of the theorist of radical democracy, Chantal Mouffe. She's argued for a multipolar world order that recognizes multiple understandings of identities, democracy, and human rights, and where politics, not governance, is the key term. For Mouffe, this plurality is a refusal of the dialectic, which establishes boundaries, exclusions, and antagonisms associated with domains of political power. Mouffe's idea of agonism entails, and this is a quote from her, how to establish this us-them distinction, which is constitutive of politics, in a way that is compatible with pluralism. A key thread in the version of multipolarity advanced by Mouffe is the acknowledgement of agonistic relationships in which gender like race may play a central role, but not imply us, them, insider-outsider distinctions. By their complexity, differential salience, and possible difference for different groups, attachment is built to a democratic project that is pluralist, engaged in discussion, fluidity, and multiplicities. A key thread is MUF's acknowledgement of a version of multipolarity in which there are multiple different vernacular ideas about democracy and engagements with politics that might or might not be secular, linked with particular institutions or ideas about rights, and by implication articulate different philosophies of education or governance, and open a terrain for examination of different kinds of inequalities. Multipolarity, from this perspective, is about a social justice project that is shifting, enacted, contested, responsive to the complexities of location and mobility. Normative frames are not pre-given. They're not canonical. They're always negotiated, accepting agonistic processes. A singular meaning of governance is not in her vocabulary. In thinking about multipolarity in relation to work on gender schooling and international identity, I want to identify a way in which the signal about gender equality and women's rights blinks on and off. So we have both senses of multipolarity as features of the contemporary terrain. We have a feature that is complicit with the existing geopolitics. Girls' education is the go-to issue often in situations of highly questionable military intervention. And we also have the sense of a multipolarity around this multiple dialogue around gender inequality. So now I want to try to present two readings of the SDGs that draw on these ideas about multipolarity. Okay, this is quite a complicated diagram that comes out of a project that I worked on with a collection of colleagues working in health, housing, and water, governance, poverty. And it was very illuminating to work from the sphere of education with people in a range of other spheres. We looked at what we considered the governance challenges associated with the SDGs, and we said that these challenges, that we could group the SDGs into three bands. In the inner core, the yellow heart, the well-being heart, are a range of goals which historically have developed to support each other. Education, health, gender equality, and so on. And the connection of these goals has historically been linked with the growth of states and a notion of the public sphere. And they're seen to complement each other. They don't necessarily, it's been a huge challenge to achieve them, but that's the well-being goals articulate with each other, and their governance agendas are homologous, if not identical. The process of audit, using indicators to monitor progress, is reasonably well established in relation to that inner yellow sphere. The outer sphere, what we've called the infrastructure goals, are very uneven. In some areas, the governance structures are public; in some, they're private. And it's quite clear that we can't achieve everything in all goals. We can't achieve the energy goal and the water goal at the same time. There's going to have to be some trade-off. But it's very weak what the governance relations are in that middle sphere. And then it's impossible to determine what they are in the outer sphere around the air and the sea. The argument we made in the project, Thinking Beyond Sectors project, was that we needed to attend to the governance challenges in the middle sphere, the orange sphere, because if we could build global governance structures that were responsive to the SDG framework at that level, it would have a beneficial effect on the inner core and the outer ring. And I think the argument I've been making about that international relations idea of multipolarity sits with that notion. Accommodate to the existing structures, geopolitical structures, accommodate to the existing geopolitical patterns, to the pattern of power between those different social sectors, and work on trade-off, work on institutional structures. But there are grave doubts given what's happened in the world really since we worked on this project and even since the SDGs were agreed last in 2015 in terms of weak economic growth and deepening geopolitical problems, that version, that hopeful version, is an appropriate reading. I want to now make a second reading of the diagram. How am I doing for time? Okay, all right. Which draws on some other work I've been doing about how to understand different ideas of inequality. I haven't developed this work using Mouffe's idea of agonism and multipolarity, but I think it sits quite comfortably with some of her notions of pluralism and heterodoxy. Central to her notion is an idea of politics rather than governance, and I find this idea of a connection particularly useful in thinking through addressing three kinds of inequalities in education, which confront the new global framework of the SDGs, and which I don't think the language of SDG 4 or the ways in which inequality is evoked in the inequality goal go far enough to do. So now I'm going to take you on another byroad through different ways of thinking about inequality, and in the end we'll come back to governance and the SDGs. Okay, I have distinguished the need to think through the lens of the capability approach about how to address three kinds of inequality in education. I have distinguished these firstly as addressing inequality of what, which is broadly speaking a distributional question about educational opportunities for governments, public formations of civil society, and private groupings like families. There is a politics to working out how to distribute fairly in relation to the inequality of what. Secondly, I have suggested the importance of considering how to use educational relationships to address the problem of inequality of whom. Here I draw on Francis Stewart's idea about horizontal inequalities. Inequality of who is broadly a question about collective identities, meaning-making, violence, and aspects of denial of dignity through curricula, textbooks, media, and pedagogic relations. Governments and governance structures can both be complicit in perpetuating horizontal inequalities. Yet governments and the form of association linked with governance can also politically challenge these inequalities. And teacher education, curriculum revision, or forms of local government and accountability may all be part of this. You can't assume it. You can't read it off. Thirdly, I have delineated a set of process inequalities in education that I have termed inequalities of how. I came to this idea of thinking about inequalities of how because when you think about it, education is a space of inequality. There's an inequality. I'm standing here. I am talking for an hour and a half, half an hour, and you're going to only ever hear your voice for 5 minutes. That's an inequality. There are people of different ages, different backgrounds, different learning styles. We learn and teach across multiple divisions. The set of engagements to address the inequality of power are crucial for whether we have a form of personal political education that is good or bad. If I was to talk endlessly and you never had a voice, that would be really bad inequality of how we address it differentially and in different ways. The learning moments to address inequality of power might be secured by governments, non-state actors in the public or private sphere, and by relations of governance. This is a space where the personal and political connect very intimately. Working for this form of equality entails pedagogic relations which require us to address differences in age, skill, levels of understanding, multilingualism, the status of different bundles of curricular knowledge. You know, much of the bread and butter of education is about really addressing inequalities of how. Governments and the wide range of stakeholders involved in the debate about governance may secure some or all of this, but they may also complicate or undo some of the unintended some with unintended consequences. The argument I want to make is that threading engagement with these three forms of inequality through the education dynamics of the SDGs offers a fruitful process, and I don't think that concern with those three dimensions of inequality is yet writ large enough in the SDG project. There are two ways in which inequalities are addressed in education in the text of the SDGs. The one is in the term quality, which recurs through the target. And the second is here in target 4, where there's this rather unspecified language about sustainability and global citizenship. The plea I'm going to make when I bring this talk to a conclusion in about 5 minutes is that I want to argue for a much more complex understanding of inequality to be part of the debates around the SDGs. I want to support this claim not only with the kind of semantic discussion I've been taking you down, but I want to just conclude by presenting some data to you. These data points come from a study I've been doing with colleagues in Nigeria, where we've been following a cohort of students who were, as they were in their last year of education degrees at universities and teacher training colleges in 5 Nigerian states. We first surveyed them in 2014. We kept in touch with them in 2015. And we did some detailed work in the schools in which some of them had found work. Now, what we were looking at was what their views were about gender equality and how much the teacher education curriculum, which had been changed in 2012 in Nigeria to introduce some ideas about gender equality, was understood or supported by the students. The distressing but not unexpected thing we found was that the very narrow way in which gender equality and inclusion was being taught meant that students had large and not very strong attitudes around gender equality and women's rights. That wasn't unexpected. But what was unexpected, and I think is heartening in terms of the argument I'm making, are these two pieces of data in relation to the work we've done in schools. This is the data on what we called children's gender equality attitudes and their attitudes around inclusion. And what it's showing is that boys and girls who had more gender equitable attitudes also felt more included. So there's a statistically significant relationship between those two indices, which I can explain in the questions if you want more information about how we calculated these. We don't know what direction this is going in. We don't know whether children who have more gender equitable attitudes are richer children and therefore teachers include them more in classroom, or whether teachers who are more inclusive actually convey more gender equality in their classroom. But what it's showing is that addressing inequality of how seems to make good pedagogic sense. And this other piece of data, which is now looking at the teachers' gender attitudes and their teaching practice, shows us that the more professional development teachers have, that's the top one, there's a statistically significant relationship with their gender equality. You can also see that there's some distressing pieces of data, so that the more teachers care about gender equality, the more they complain about their work conditions. And the more they also feel not able to practice inclusion. But I'm using these two pieces of data to support the argument I'm making about the importance of thinking about different kinds of inequality, and to actually stress the complementarity of the two ideas of multipolarity I was trying to draw. Because I want to keep in the frame of thinking about global governance, the many dimensions of inequality, violence, and injustice. If we're to evaluate governance regimes and approaches to accountability through a politics of research, critical policy scholarship, and consideration of practice, we cannot only accept the current regimes of power and global, national, and local levels. We need to continue to outline and to critically examine our normative compass in every sphere of education, drawing on a politics of critical review, of connection, compassion, and evaluation that links the practice of working with global education frameworks to the process of being both located and mobile, and in this openness and complexity, vulnerably human. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Elaine. I will now give the floor for our group of senior researchers, David, Terhi, and Elina. Please, you have prepared some comments and questions to Elaine, so please feel free.
Hello, my name is Terhi Nokkala, and I work as a senior researcher at the Finnish Institute for Education Research. I'm just wondering whether it's, you know, should we introduce ourselves, all of us, at the beginning? That probably makes most.
This is a good idea for me to introduce myself because I always forget to introduce myself. My name is Dave Hoffman. I'm also a senior researcher at the Finnish Institute of Educational Research. Work together with Terhi.
Would you like to repeat if we didn't hear well? Can you hear me well now? I think we have to hold the microphone a little bit closer. Do you want us to repeat very briefly?
So, Terhi Nokkala, Finnish Institute for Education Research.
Dave Hoffman, Senior Researcher, Finnish Institute of Educational Research.
And my name is Elina Lehtomäki, and I work at the Faculty of Education here at the University of Jyväskylä. And we have prepared some questions and comments.
I would like to thank you for the opportunity to listen to your genuinely interesting presentation, and also thank the organizers for having a possibility or having an opportunity to raise a few questions on it. My questions are centered around the possibility of resistance to hegemonic discourses and global governance frameworks on the one hand, and on the possibility of change on the other hand, for the better or for the worse. Firstly, I would be interested in your opinion on to what extent, compared with the Millennium Development Goals, the Sustainable Development Goals offer a genuine possibility for change, or are they equally just kind of tokenistic nods towards equality and not the kind of work that would genuinely bring about real equality? And what are the preconditions that are sort of necessary for multilateral policy frameworks to bring about genuine change? Is the multipolarity, as it is advocated by Chantal Mouffe, the answer? And in general, under the conditions of the hegemonic discourses of globalization, good governance, as it is defined as economic and performative accountability, a new public management, is there a true possibility for counter-hegemony globalization to emerge, or what Boaventura de Sousa Santos would call insurgent cosmopolitanism? In his article from 2006 on globalizations, de Sousa Santos lauds the sort of Seattle World Social Forum in 1999 as a momentum for change and as an indication that, okay, now we're moving for the better. But it seems to me that in the post-2008 era of economic austerity, the general atmosphere has just gotten worse. And secondly, are there conditions, in your opinion, under which things could change for the worse? For example, the current refugee crisis, will it erode any remaining solidarity between the global north and the global south? And finally, from your perspective, what is your view on the global governance through trade agreements, such as the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnerships, or on a global level, the General Agreement on Trade in Services? How likely is it that education or related elements that contribute to genuine gender equality, for example, or the multiple definitions of equalities and inequalities as you define them, what sort of elements of these trade agreements can sort of, you know, have an impact on the way in which equality can truly progress? And sort of what are the consequences for equality of these kinds of multilateral trade agreements? Can they change things for the worse? I suppose that was sort of the gist of it.
Thanks for the observations, and I it's whether there's the smiley face or the sad face on my shoulder, but which one I turn to, and I think you evoke in some ways the uncertainties of the time in which we live, and I think I'm really very pessimistic at the moment. I think I've become more pessimistic as the months have progressed since the SDGs were adopted in 2015. The global economic downturn, the refugee crisis. I think there's a possibility Britain might vote to leave the EU, and for all the unevennesses of what's the EU has accomplished, social Europe and some idea of social compact. From Britain, that's really important for people who care about equalities, and all of that might go. So, and in countries, South Africa and Nigeria, where I've been working and been the last few months, things are very fragile. So I think you're absolutely correct to say that things can get worse. However, I think even in the face of things getting worse, that's the point of having a social justice framework. It's the point of having a notion of that you're oriented somewhere. So having a belief in equality and having the opportunity to struggle for it is very important to hang on to in times when things get worse. And that was why I guess I told the story about gender equality, the kind of nerdy story about being so pleased about how gender equality snaggled its way back into the SDG text. Because now it's there. And now there is a way in which gender equality activists or race equality activists can in some way get involved with a agenda that's extremely negative and can inch it somewhere. So I don't have huge visions, but I have this notion that there's a compass, or that if we can bend somewhere in the direction towards justice, to use that Martin Luther King phrase, it's better than just giving up and saying we're on the seas and tides of rampant globe and capitalism, even those are the seas and tides that we're on. With regard to I guess TTIP and the trade agreements encapsulate that in a way. So there's one reading with it that everything about it is just about protecting global capitalism. And yet, again, if we can in some way argue that the health sector and the education sector are to be exempted from TTIP, that they can, that these investor-state settlement of disputes will not apply to the social sector, that will be a small gain. So I'm saying the terrain is not good, but we mustn't lose sight that we can make small gains, and we mustn't lose the sense of where we've come from, that education has often been part of very important social democratic projects. It's been part of discourses around equality, and it still remains the language in which we can talk social justice. I don't think they talk social justice in business schools as much as we talk it in education. So can I leave it there? I mean, there's lots more to be said.
I'm sure we have opportunities.
Thank you.
Thank you for the excellent presentation. You mentioned the important issue in your presentation, and you referred to that as participatory processes in the preparation of the Sustainable Development Goals. How do you see the role of research in this participatory process? You must have looked at a little bit also. You mentioned that it's non-governmental organizations or civil society organizations that participated more efficiently than before. What about the research community? And how do you see for the future, if the picture looks a little bit, could we say, gloomy or pessimistic, according to Terhi, and also you also mentioned that well, things may go worse. And I think we have seen now in the recent changes that things do change more rapidly than we do expect, and to directions that we do not expect. And then that raises, I think, the question that begs the question, how do you see education research collaboration or research collaboration in general? What influence could research collaboration? Research goes global, as do, well, capitalism, governance, global education, governance, etc. So what is the role of research collaboration in this?
Globalization. It's okay.
Elevator music behind.
Yeah, it's lifting our mood. Thank you. Thanks, Elena. Obviously, because I'm an academic and I have the luxury and the pleasure of working in a university and the opportunities for these wonderful collaborations, wonderful dialogues, wonderful opportunities to meet with people, I see this as an important space. And it's a space that is... contradictorily located, because to some extent it's the space that is given, it is learning knowledge economies. Learning economies, they are economies that are duty-free and they don't talk about equality or values. But on the other hand, there is a space for critical discussion. And the research, the NGO community, the critical scholarly community that drove and that fed into the debate around the SDGs had grown up in 2000. It had grown up through all kinds of processes, be it those citizen assessments, be it the critique of the narrowness of the MDGs, be it sometimes nationally led assertions of we're doing rights, education rights in our way, in our car. We've had I led this research project on the interpretation of the MDGs in South Africa and Kenya and amongst and in global organizations. And our analysis of our data, we talk about a missing middle, that a lot of the sociology, critical sociology of the policy says this, the policy happens here and it's implemented here, and we don't look at all these people in the middle. Actually, all of us are part of that group in the middle, and we're all negotiating, engaging, talking, contributing, and there's been a huge flowering of this process. Now, sometimes it's quite shallow, sometimes it can be sound bites, sometimes it can be driven by research kind of straitjackets, randomized controlled trials were that for a certain period. But it's a very vibrant sort of sphere of debate, a sphere of democratic iteration, to use Sheila Ben-Habib's term. So I think that participatory process, it's not going to go away. The genie's out of the bottle and hope is one of the things that's flying around. All sorts of other bad fairies are also flying around, but hope is also one of them.
Can you guys hear me in this microphone? Okay, thanks a lot. Professor, thank you so much for coming here and the wonderful speech you gave, and I especially want to congratulate you on pointing out something that in Finnish academia we're not very good at pointing out, who's sitting up here and who's sitting out there, and who never gets to enter this campus or the building except at very circumscribed times. I'm very appreciative to hear that. And I guess my first remark, actually it's for the audience. Mainly I would really, this is pretty relaxed compared to what we often do in academia, and much of what we do in the space you just described, it's kind of regarded as mysterious, things like this, and it's not really that mysterious, and we ought to demystify a lot of it, and especially when we have opportunity to do a dialogue with people who have come from a long way, whether it's from Helsinki or from New York, and we should take that opportunity to do that. And one concrete question I would have is in your the way you thought about how to reconcile some of the relationships, I was missing the why and the who, what. I was missing the why there. I'm not sure if that even makes sense in the way you did that. But I think that basically my guess is knowing the particular students we're lucky enough to have in this room, they're pretty ready to go. But I wouldn't mind hearing about the where's the why and the who, what, how, why.
Thanks very much. I guess for me, this is the why. I want to, where this diagram puts sustainable development in the center, I want to put social justice in the center. And I want to put social justice as an idea that says that those inequalities of who, inequalities of what, and inequalities of how are all inequalities we're going to address, and that our grappling with sustainable development is not just about giving people packages of things. It's about developing a social justice agenda that recognizes dignity, recognizes opportunities, and we'll do our best to make a world in which that can flourish, not be constrained, not make that be betrayed, and not make that be hollowed out. So, I can't give the sound bite, but I want to say that that I want to place social... And I'm very... one of the problems about this contemporary time, which I didn't bring out enough in response to the first question, is there's a kind of level of deceit. So one of the ministers in the current government in the UK, who has been most cruel in the policies he's promoted around austerity, runs an institute for social justice. So the terms, many of the terms that we associate, you think that the kernel is secure, and that's one of these processes, and I think those are some of the points that have been made by the World Social Forum debates, that there's a hollowing out of our lexicon. Cosmopolitanism is another term. It's used, you know, to describe global elites, and not to develop the notion of justice and equality. And so there's a huge struggle over meaning. And so one of the whys is to anchor the social justice project in real places, real lives, and real aspirations for equality and dignity and rights. Am I answering you enough?
Mainly, let me follow up with one brief one. If I try to put myself in the shoes of many people in the audience, I'll even read this one. Okay, a challenge facing many of the people in this room is the practical realities of affecting policy debate in general, policy uptake in particular. Many of the theses I read, or even dissertations, express admirable admiration with regard to explaining, informing, or even impacting the policy process or the implementation and reform linked to policy initiatives. Putting yourself in the shoes of the people in this room, some of whom have not even selected a master's degree topic, what kind of advice, practical, actionable advice do you have for these? We've been talking about some really interesting relationships and possibilities. What can we bring it back into the classroom for everybody?
I think it's wonderful, you know, to see so many young faces in front of me, and for you all to know that, you know, your life in this area is long. There will be many ups and downs to it, and there will be many disappointments. But I think this world is a world in which people have the capacity to change policy. It can be at very, very local levels. I think what this data shows is, in a particular classroom, if you develop particular kinds of relationships with children, those are relationships that people carry through their lives. You can carry hope or despair with you through your life. So what a teacher does and how a school creates an ethos of equality and dignity and orientation to others, concern with the rest of the world, those are immensely important. They don't just stay on the page. They grow, and I think they're, you know, like the filings on a magnet. They attract other things to them. So I think, don't think about policy as only way out there, and if you can't reach the UN, although the UN, if you'll go on the SDG site, is very, very interested to hear from you. It's both in your local setting, it's in your national setting, it's in your university, it's in your friendships, it's in your ideas, it's definitely in your essay. Many, many of these ideas that I'm trying to pull together have been churned around by, you know, they began in compelling questions students asked, and students have gone on asking. So intervene, engage the dialogue. What clothes is hope wearing? Hope is wearing dialogue, discussion, and talks many, many languages. There isn't just one language. There isn't just one way to intervene in these processes. It's very multifaceted. And I think that was what I was trying to evoke through the Chantal Mouffe notion of heterodoxy and pluralism. There are many ways to engage, and many places, and with many people. And it's yours. I mean, it doesn't mean those big geopolitical forces are not there. They're incredibly powerful, and their capacity to make things significantly worse is very present. I don't want to overlook that for a minute, but we are privileged to be able to talk to each other, to respond to each other, and to be open to each other, and to critique each other.
Thank you, Elina Terhi and David, and especially. I think it's now time to invite you into the dialogue, engage in debate. So, dear students, colleagues, the floor is now yours, so you may address issues that you found interesting, critical to Elaine, or then to our colleagues in here. So, okay, Hannu, maybe you can start.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. And very interesting presentation, and I just would like to make sure that I have understood it correctly. Because we do have some 300-400 years experience and tradition, I would call it missionary approach, to bring all good things since the right faith, the right faith of the education, to different countries and areas and peoples in the world. So from top down to big brother to the young brother, etc. And that's why I would like to cite, this is an Anglo-American person, I'm sorry, but Harvey Goldstein is an eminent statistician, actually. Harvey Goldstein wrote about education for all. Each educational system can develop different criteria for assessing quality, enrollment, etc. And instead of monitoring progress towards an essentially artificial set of targets, Education for All could concentrate the resources that it is able to mobilize towards obtaining the necessary understanding of the dynamics of each system. This would then allow, so only this would then allow, constructive policies to be implemented. The emphasis would be on the local context and culture, within which those with local knowledge can construct their own aims rather than rely upon common yardsticks implemented from a global perspective. I'm asking, I heard you using, for example, word dignity, which is disappeared from the Finnish language. We know we do not speak about arvokkuus in Finnish, or maybe a watch is arvokas. So we do not use that, but that's a very old-fashioned word, so to say. And I was happy to hear that, but I didn't hear you using the more modern word as ownership of these reforms. So when you spoke about the Nike, I don't know if we do have anybody from Nigeria. No. Because I'm wondering how much you emphasize now on ex ante analysis of the dynamics of the field there where you assume to bring some new, nice, beautiful things? Or are we still in the situation where we just go to the field and start changing the things and then doing the analysis in the evening? So how strong is a systematic ex ante, so before going to implement some wonderful things over there? How important is this ex ante analysis? That was a bit unclear to me in your wonderful presentation.
Shall I respond? Yeah. Thanks for the question. I think there are two or three layers to it, and I think I might answer it from the middle outwards, possibly. The kind of critique Harvey Goldstein made is now acknowledged in the SDG framework. So there will be indicators that are global, and both rich and poor countries will be monitored. But countries can set their own indicators. And it's recognized that the MDG framework with the aggregated indicators and those critiques, I think, have been, that argument is won. So in some ways, the measurement of around these targets, each country can decide how to do it, and blocks of countries could say, we'll look at how we've progressed together. But I think you were actually also asking another question, which was a question about what's the point of these frameworks, and do these frameworks not just get in the way of national politics? And I want to and national politics around rights, or national politics around changing education systems. My response to that comes from the GEGPRI project, the research project I did on the interpretation of the MDGs in Kenya and South Africa and in selected global organizations, the one where I was talking about the relations between the middle. And one of our findings from that project was how the MDGs were seen depends on what the politics of that country are. So that in Kenya, which was a highly aid-dependent country, and where the MDGs were associated with a top-down aid package that was really quite neglectful of the complexities of politics around education in Kenya, they were... there was a kind of genuflection towards the MDGs by the top civil servants who knew that that was where their money was coming from. And there was complete lack of knowledge of the MDGs down below, which we would sort of at school level. But in South Africa, where there was at that stage, there was still a lot of anti-apartheid activists who were in politics and NGOs. The MDGs were seen as allowing, providing a platform on which larger demands could be made. So people could take the MDG platform and use it to advance other goals around substantive equality or addressing violence against women or so on. And I think that probably we will have the same process around the SDGs. In some countries, they will be... people will ignore them because there'll be a whole set of other politics going on. In some countries, they will be really important because they can support other processes that might. So there isn't one kind of ownership. There are different kinds of ownerships linked to different historical locations. And while the SDG technically recognizes that in the measurement agenda, I think politically it puts on the agenda the kind of open discursive democratic iterations. Whether they're going to go somewhere or not, that's going to depend on big material forces. So I know I'm ducking and diving, but I'm trying to answer both layers.
Thank you, Elaine. You are totally entitled to do that. Any other comments, questions from the audience? Or would you colleagues there behind the table continue the conversation with regards to the issue of ownership? There's Yuma, please.
Thank you very much. I'm Said from Tanzania. My question is closely related to the previous question. These SDGs and Millennium Development Goals and AFA goals are global. And we know the world is divided. Now, do you think it's possible for all countries from the global north and the global south to reach all the goals at the same time, considering the division between them, the gap between them, the gap that we have now? And these SDGs say all girls, like the first one, all girls and boys complete free, equitable, quality primary and secondary education. Is it possible for that target to be reached equally in all countries?
I think we have to acknowledge that it isn't going to be possible, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. And I think one of the complexities around the measurement agenda has been that the first rounds of audit and measurement were just counting how many people cross a line, how many children enroll in school. And you had perverse consequences. So I did some work in Ghana where there were large numbers of children, many more children on the register than many more children, counted as attending school than were enrolled. The reason that was is that the schools got their money according to how many children were noted as attending. So you had perverse consequences coming from a measurement agenda that was just about audit and tick box who's there and who's not there. But you've had the emergence of, I think, some very interesting instruments of evaluating rights. One I could draw your attention to is a book written by Susan Randolph and Sakiko Fukudapar on what's called the SURF Index. And the SURF Index is looking at the achievement of socioeconomic rights in relation to how much resources a country has. So you don't measure Tanzania as against Finland because you've got looking at completely different tax bases. You're looking at completely different levels of resource. And if we were to, unfortunately at the moment, the SURF Index only has two data points around education. But we could unpack, we could use that same methodology, and we could measure these targets in ways that said, how can you expand the resource base of Tanzania, and what do you need to do to support those resources, and how does the inequality of where wealth resides in the world, how does this so grossly take away from the needs of a country like Tanzania, which the old method of audit never allowed us to do. So I think the question behind the question, which while you're asking the question around measurement, I think it's clearly a question around how do we address the inequality of resources? And one way to address those inequality of resources is to name them. Once they're named, you can start redirecting them. But so that's again answering in a hopeful voice. And there's a lot that can get in the way of those things being easily achieved, as you know, we've seen in the last week the news about huge amounts of global money being kept out of the Panama Papers have revealed how much money is kept out of national jurisdictions and tax systems.
Right. Thank you all. I think we need to have our coffee break now, and I start building the connections to New York, and we all keep our fingers crossed. Thank you very much for the audience, for our speakers.